From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. You don't know how much we value you. We're very thankful for your support. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, May 1st brings the Orthodox Christian celebration of Easter, as well as the Wicca and pagan observance of Beltane Samhain. Monday is the Baha'i's 12th day of Ridwan, and on Thursday, Muslims mark Lailat al-Miraj. That day is also the Jewish Yom HaShoah. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, Trump. That's the result of the latest round of GOP presidential primaries on Tuesday. And naturally, Ted Cruz responded to his five losses by naming a running mate, Carly Fiorina, who immediately burst into song. Wait, you mean you didn't hear this?
'Cause we travel on the bus all day, we get to play, we get to...
Sadly, on the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton picked up four states to Bernie Sanders' one, meaning there were no running mate announcements and no singing. In Kentucky, up to $18 million in tax incentives have been approved for the Ark Encounter theme park. A judge reversed a previous ruling that a Christian park employing only Christians was not eligible for taxpayer support. After a delay that gave hope to Tennessee non-extremists, Governor Bill Haslam went ahead and signed the state's ill-advised Counselor Shield Law, a first in the nation. It permits mental health professionals to reject patients based on personal beliefs. And even as the backlash to North Carolina's notorious anti-transgender bathroom bill continues to mount, a right-wing boycott pledge of Target stores protesting that chain's inclusive policies has grown to over 900,000 signatures. The campaign was spearheaded naturally by the supposedly Christian American Family Association. Now, here's what's coming up on State of Belief Radio.
I see nothing. I know nothing.
Why does it seem more and more difficult to have a fact-based conversation about more and more topics? From climate change to LGBT rights to politics. Is more information resulting in less knowledge, as some experts suggest? Or is something even more insidious at play? Perhaps a deliberate dumbing down of debate around critically important issues? On this week's show, you'll meet Dr. Robert Proctor, who literally wrote the book on the ignorance industry and coined a word for this phenomenon, agnotology.
I have always been fascinated by God. Why do people all around the world worship their God so differently?
For the past 4 weeks, the National Geographic Television Channel has been airing a series titled The Story of God, narrated by Morgan Freeman, who twice has actually played God in feature films. The series explores belief around the world. With 2 weeks of The Story of God left to run, I'll talk with executive producer James Younger. But first,
I think we've got this liberal mentality that everything that you have belongs to the government and it's a benefit and privilege that they don't take it away from you. That's the reverse. It belongs to you and they shouldn't take what belongs to God. Okay?
It's a touchy subject. In many parts of the country, houses of worship provide services to the greater community, even as they retain various degrees of autonomy over who gets to work for them and what faith-based policies they enforce. These churches, synagogues, other organizations already enjoy tax-exempt status. So what happens when they ask for direct government support of the services they provide? Well, one such instance is in front of the Supreme Court in the form of a Missouri case called Trinity Lutheran Church of Columbia, Inc. versus Pauley. But the issue comes up on a regular basis, and the bigger challenge is finding a way even to talk about it that makes clear that in the long run, keeping government dollars separate from religion benefits both government and religion. To address this challenge, I'm joined by Rabbi Jack Moline, president of Interfaith Alliance. Jack, welcome back to State of Belief.
Thank you, Welton. It is always a pleasure to be here.
Jack, all too often, any objection to something like a government grant to a church-run playground, as is the case in this example in Missouri, is immediately seen as being anti-religion. Why isn't it?
Oh, Welton, I have to tell you, in this case, it's even worse than that. What's at stake here is ground tires that are providing a rubberized and therefore soft platform for children on a playground. So not only when we oppose this are we seen as anti-religion, we're seen as anti-children. And it's really uncomfortable to look in the face of somebody and make this case, I know. But the fact of the matter is that this isn't really about rubber pellets on a playground in a church backyard. This is about providing the opportunity for groups like the Family Research Council, groups led by folks like Tony Perkins, to create a wedge into government funding that allows them to redirect taxpayer dollars designed for the general good into religious institutions which serve only their constituencies. Or if they do serve a broader public, they do so in the name of promoting their own religious agenda. So it behooves us, as champions of religious freedom, as people who refuse to weaponize the First Amendment, to stand up, even in these cases that seem so innocuous as beautifying and making safer a playground for children in back of a church.
What are the long-term risks to both the community and the religious organization in this kind of situation?
People will look at this particular case, and it's the one that's going to be argued in front of the Supreme Court. So the details of the case are going to take a front seat in the publications of the religious right over the principles of the case. But the extension of this is that when government funds are indeed made available for private institutions, or institutions in the private sector is a better way to put it, to serve the genuine needs of the community, there will be religious institutions that will step forward and, on the precedent of what could be a decision in favor of this church, will say, well, now we need to provide funds for reconstructing our building that was damaged in a storm, or we need to be eligible for grants from the pool of public money for education to educate the children who are in our private school. And eventually, well-organized, privately funded, and tax-exempt religious organizations can begin to make the same claims on the blessings of life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness that are supposed to be guaranteed to all Americans, regardless of their belief system, by U.S. tax dollars in a public and secular setting.
Mm-hmm. You know, Jack, I was reminded over and over of an issue that I had to deal with when I was sitting in the chair you're sitting in now, and that was after the devastation of Hurricane Sandy. It was difficult for Interfaith Alliance to come out against federal funding for the repair of houses of worship because the immediate situation was so concrete and the matter of principles seemed so abstract. So help listeners to find a way of talking about these issues, because they are bound to come up again and again as long as we're in this tug of war between a kind of authentic religious freedom and a manipulated religious freedom.
Well, and I know how difficult it was for you during that period and how necessary it was for you to take this position against the complaints of a lot of people who are longtime supporters of us. It is very hard to look a disaster or tragedy in the face, even more so than looking at a playground and saying, wow, here's this pot of money. It is there to help all sorts of private citizens and private businesses to recover from a disaster like this. Maybe there are even attached buildings on either side of a house of worship. Why in the world would we not want public money to be used for the benefit of people who are just as much citizens of the United States as people who don't share their religious convictions? Why do we seem to be discriminating against those citizens? And I have to say, from up close, it's a very difficult argument to make. But if you take a step back and you realize that those buildings were constructed through the private donations, the charitable donations of individual citizens who received a tax break for them, a deduction on their income tax, who sustain those institutions with tax-deductible dollars, whose clergy serve that congregation and serve the communities around them with certain tax advantages that you and I, Welton, know we both have enjoyed because of our years in the pulpit. There are already all sorts of support mechanisms that exist to make sure that these locations of community support and moral guidance exist in our community so that we can have healthy communities that can support citizens in times of need and to meet the needs, the rights, and the privileges that are a part of being an American citizen. But these are the ultimate private institutions, a house of worship, a place of religious study, a place of religious engagement. And we have to encourage people to take enough of a step back to understand that before a disaster struck, the government had already provided the lion's share of assistance to these institutions to be able to serve their private constituencies.
I think a Supreme Court case like this is not just about that one event. It could have long-standing implications and ramifications in the future.
So, Welton, one of the things that's always made me proud of Interfaith Alliance is that in spite of our constant need for support from our membership, we haven't tried to exploit both sides of an issue to try to pry contributions out of our members. Not that we would turn down a contribution, but I've seen the literature that's coming out of the religious right around this particular issue. And on the one hand, they're saying, send us money. The government wants to take away our rights to believe what we want to believe about human sexuality and about marriage and about worship. Send us money so that we can fight the government and the liberal agenda on this cause. And on the other hand, they're saying, send us money so that we can make our brief to the government that they should be supporting us in everything that we're doing because all we want to do is bring blessing to these United States of America the way it ought to be done through our particular religious perspective. It's about money either way you look at it. It is a constant demand for contributions. And it sort of breaks my heart that in a reaction formation to that, you and I are both a little reluctant to turn to our listeners and our supporters and say, look, if we're going to fight these folks, we need the resources. But I know what we sound like. We sound like them when we say, send us money because of this and send us money because of that, and let's play both ends against the middle. That is a horrifying and distressing tactic from people who lay claim, at least, to being the arbiters of conscience and morality in this country.
Well, Jack, I could tell you, and I know you already know it, but I can tell our listeners as well as you, that at this point in history, those in the religious right who are asking for money for multiple reasons that we question, if not outright oppose, they're getting a lot more money than we are. And it's difficult to contradict publicly and powerfully what they're doing when we have so many less resources than they do.
I don't think we have less resources, Welton. We just have not quite figured out how to politely ask for them. So that's what I'll do. Please, please help us out.
Good. Now, look, I can't let you go during an election campaign without, I don't even know what to ask you. I just want to know how you're feeling about what you're seeing going on.
I think that there is a desire in this country to feel a passion again. And I think we've seen it on both sides of the aisles, although we have candidates who are exploiting passion in different ways. We have some candidates who, in enabling people to feel strongly about something again, have tapped into a well of anger that whatever they imagine used to be the way things were has somehow slipped away. And it's up to us to turn the clock back and try to recapture what used to be. I remember these kinds of attitudes from when you and I were a lot younger, and there were a generation of people who believed that what was happening in this country, the social change that happened in the middle of the 20th century, was somehow a betrayal of the values and the traditions that had preceded us, and they were angry about it, and they wanted to turn the clock back. On the other hand, there are people who think that the mess that they believe we're in is the result of what came before, and now we need wholesale change in order to bring us into a new kind of future. And I remember that from the 60s and 70s as well. I might even plead guilty to a little bit of that myself. What we need are people who recognize the value of our roots and recognize the necessity of the branches that reach upward and outward from the trunk of the tree, but not somebody who wants to cut the trunk down. That kills both the future and the past. We need, in this country, candidates at every level of government who are going to pledge that the values that make America great will continue to be the values that they enforce, and that the protection of religious freedom, the resistance to all sorts of bigotry, and commitment to the civic responsibilities of American citizenship are going to be the hallmarks of government on the federal, state, and local levels.
Rabbi Jack Moline is president of Interfaith Alliance. With decades of experience as a congregational leader, Jack has also spent many years on the front lines of the struggle to protect faith and freedom. Jack, as always, thank you for being with us again. We're always glad to hear your voice on State of Belief.
Thanks, Welton. Nice to be here.
On a remarkably regular basis around here, we go to throw our hands up in frustration and declare, how can people be so wrong about this? Whatever the this might be in any given case, there's evidence that in this age of boundless information, one of the victims is knowledge. But my next guest has invested a great deal of time into researching something even darker, the shadowy science of manufactured ignorance. It was 1995 that Dr. Robert Proctor coined the term agnotology, and he was the first historian to testify against the cigarette industry and its insistence on, pardon the expression, blowing smoke about the relationship between tobacco and disease. Sadly, other industries, interest groups, and even politicians have continued to refine this dark art with remarkable success. So I am both happy and a little bit nervous to welcome Dr. Proctor to State of Belief Radio. Robert, welcome.
Hey, how you doing? Well,
is there a short description of this idea that could serve as an introduction here today?
Sure. Well, we live in a golden age of ignorance. Some call it the Endarkenment. And agnotology, this word I coined, is it's both the study of ignorance, the history of ignorance, the politics of ignorance, but it's also the fact that a lot of people and groups out there want you to be ignorant. So agnotology is really about the production of ignorance, the deliberate production of ignorance.
Well, you write that this started with the tobacco industry. What was that prototype?
Well, in 1969, Brown and Williamson, the maker of Cool cigarettes, had a secret internal memo that we finally got through litigation, and it said, doubt is our product. We make cigarettes, but we can really only keep making cigarettes if we keep making ignorance. And they went to a great deal of effort to keep people in the dark about the unbelievably different kinds of harms that cigarettes can cause, that cigarettes are the main cause of amputations, leading cause of blindness, the world's leading cause of fire death, and many other things you can't believe. And those things were kept in the dark from lots of people, and that's how they kept in business.
I think this kind of rhetoric will be familiar to pretty much all of our listeners, but where have you seen this phenomenon pop up most effectively across the years?
Well, it's actually a great question, because the guy who ended up being executive director for the conspiracy, the tobacco conspiracy in the 50s, he had been president of the Sugar Research Foundation. And there was an epidemic of obesity already in the early 20th century, 1910s, 1920s, thanks to the invention of candy bars, soda pop, ice cream, and a whole sort of raft of other concentrated sugar products, which had never existed before. That gave rise to a sugar epidemic, and the Sugar Research Foundation was involved in basically spreading ignorance about sugar already, and those same techniques were used with tobacco. Other groups were doing the same thing. The Lead Institute, you know, there was an effort to ban leaded paint and leaded gasoline in the 1920s. Because of the harms it was doing to children. And the Lead Institute itself put out a doubt campaign. So these techniques of keeping people in the dark have been around for a while. It's just they seem to have accelerated in recent years, and now they're built into, you know, cars, VWs, and we have climate denial based on the tobacco mold, and we have increased sugar denial, concussion denial, that was a formal conspiracy. So these are becoming, unfortunately, recognized techniques to keep people in the dark.
Robert, you're a historian. How did you move from your interest and inquisitiveness about this phenomenon to jump right into the middle of it and began addressing this manufactured ignorance?
Well, I was also a graduate student in Germany, and I started writing on Nazi science because everyone was ignoring that. And I was in lectures where there would be doctors, old doctors, showing slides from people killed at Auschwitz and things like that. And so there was a medical student movement to say, hey, what's going on? Why are there still these old Nazi doctors teaching? And so I wrote a whole book on that, and that kind of was a mark as well. How could people be ignoring this role of doctors in the Holocaust? And then I was, you know, got into the tobacco thing, and I got into some other things, and I realized that the creation of ignorance could be studied as a topic in itself. And so I got a lot of other colleagues together, and they said, wow, yeah, this is, there's a lot of people who want you to be ignorant. And it's not all bad, by the way. You know, you don't want scientific journals publishing how to make AIDS airborne. You know, you don't want them publishing on the vulnerable spots of our nation to a terrorist attack or something. So there's a lot of virtuous ignorance as well, and that's been another thing we study.
A lot has been written about how social media has led to so many of us living our lives in information silos, where we're mostly exposed to ideas we already agree with, which only reinforces them. So what happens when you inject agnotology into that environment?
Well, I think that's a great example, Welton, because people can just tunnel down into their own, as you say, silos.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something we call confirmation bias. You know, you can look up what you want to find on the internet, and you're very likely to find it. And that has created a kind of tunnel vision, a kind of siloing, kind of narrowness, a kind of agnotology of not seeing a bigger picture.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a real big problem. You're able to reinforce your little world of ignorance, I guess you could say,
mm-hmm.
with the internet. And that's a big problem.
Hmm. I'm almost afraid to ask this, but where else have you seen techniques like this in play, historically speaking?
Well, a big one, of course, is the U.S. military. There are over 4,000 official censors right under President Obama who censor all the nuclear secrets. There's the NSA. We have a lot of secret organizations in the U.S. or quiet organizations, the National Reconnaissance Office and things like the Black Ops. So there's a whole world of secrecy, secret scientific journals. But, you know, every basic producer of a harmful product, whether that be salt or whatever, has an institute to defend itself. There are 1,500 of these in Washington, D.C., and so that might be the methyl chloral, you know, butyl ether task force, mm-hmm. or the meat institute or the egg institute. So any producer that's worried about the effects of their product will often have a trade association, and they're often involved with massaging knowledge or mm-hmm. creating ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
And again, they're often called trade associations, but they have power, they've got money, they've got lobbyists, and they work to keep people in the dark as much as they can.
Hmm. I don't usually sound quite as cynical as I'm going to sound in asking this question, but are political consultants now studying agnotology?
Oh, of course they are. Of course they are. Well, I mean, the example, even the Tobacco Institute in the early 70s, when they produced propaganda films blaming cancer on air pollution, on chemicals in our environment,
mm-hmm.
you know, instead anything but tobacco, they actually made films, and they would measure the amount of ignorance they created. They would show a propaganda film blaming cigarettes on air pollution and viruses and your genetic constitution. Then they would measure the ignorance created, you know, before and after. So they would do a survey. Do you believe cigarettes cause cancer? And they'd get 55% or whatever. And then they'd show the film, and it would drop down to 42%. So they were actually able to quantify down to a decimal point how much ignorance they were creating. So that was a very deliberate act, and I have no doubt that there are other trade associations doing the same thing.
Hmm. So when you watch television, and for example, during the campaign season that we're in right now, do you find yourself shouting at the television very often?
Of course. I mean, look at what people are saying. You have the whole Republican Party saying that climate change is a hoax. You know, you've got all kinds of mythologies about what's really going on. You have all kinds of ignorance
mm-hmm.
about the world, about, you know, what should be done. And it's kind of an abomination,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's frightening. And that, I guess, is part of the problem. You have this echo chamber media that gives a voice to these voices of extremes, of ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, you know, well, more agnotology, I guess, more books I can write.
Well, you know, I mean, it's interesting because the principle here, if I'm understanding it correctly, is, yeah, it's important what you hear, politicians or anybody, but politicians that we're talking about right now, it's important that you hear what they say, but it's equally important to know what they didn't say.
Exactly. Well, that's why a lot of agnotology works, is just by deletion, by what you leave off, what's not said,
mm-hmm.
seeing the invisible. You
mm-hmm.
know, the sort of whole field of human origins is about that, is reconstructing the invisible from faint traces.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the whole project of history, that sort of art and science of memory. since almost everything is destroyed and lost to memory, how can we reconstruct it? But the same way, as you say, you know, what's not being said? What's being left out?
Mm-hmm.
What's not news? You know, again, Zika is news. Why is cigarette death not news? You know, so what gets hidden deliberately or not? And that's another, you know, field for agnotology.
Yeah. Robert, have you or any of your colleagues in this science looked at agnotology in relation to religion?
Well, sure we have. Sure we have. There's even some old, there's an older science called agnoiology about that which, of what we must necessarily remain ignorant. So there is a dimension of religion there, and that's not sufficiently explored, by the way. The things we cannot know, the things we might know. The Big Bang violates every law of physics. You know, that's a weird, freaky thing.
Yeah.
So there's, I think there's all kinds of room there to understand mystery, to understand wonder, and to sort of restore humility. And I think there is a big religious element, but I hope it's explored more. We've only really just begun to explore that.
Yeah. Well, I, of course, am very interested in religion and have been around it all of my life. And just in preparing for this interview, I could see a lot of places, and it's not only related to mystery and theology and all of that. Sometimes it's even more practical about not telling, for example, a leader, not telling a congregation something, because for the leader to hold that in his or her own mind gives them a priority place in defining what people need to say.
Yes, yes. Well, that's beautiful. That's the type of humility that's very important.
So what's the antidote?
Well, I think the antidote is more wisdom, searching, the eternal search. That's what we're here for, is really to find the truth.
Mm-hmm.
To let the scales fall from our eyes, you know, to open our minds without letting our brains fall out. That's what my dad used to say. You don't want to be so open-minded your brains fall out. To realize there are not always two sides to every story. The truth is a coin with one side. It doesn't have two sides.
Mm-hmm.
You don't always have to balance two things off of each other. The media often will say, well, there's two sides to the story, you know. Climate change, people say this, and other people say that. The truth has one face, and that's the face we need to find and seek out, and I think that will set us free.
Boy, that's a great comment right there. How optimistic are you that we might one day become less vulnerable to this and arrive at, instead of what you said, a golden age of ignorance to a new age of reason, if I may use that term?
Well, I'm always an optimist. I think we have to be both optimistic and realistic. Realistic to know the weight of the danger, but optimistic because we do have great skill, we have great knowledge, we have creativity, we have young people. In a way, there's a beauty to death because it, without death, there could be no birth.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the new generation that often has the greatest possibilities. So I'm tremendously optimistic. I think we have a great ability to cleanse ourselves and to advance and progress. So I'm always hopeful.
Robert Proctor is professor of the history of science at Stanford University. Dr. Proctor holds a doctorate from Harvard University and is credited with coining the term agnotology to describe the dark art of manufactured ignorance. In 2008, he co-edited a seminal book on the subject, Agnotology, The Making and Unmaking of Ignorance. I'm going, listeners, I'm going to put this as plainly as I can. If you think you're immune to this stuff, then you are among the most vulnerable. Robert, to you, this work unmasks some vitally important aspects of the forces at play to create what we believe and what we think we know. I really can't tell you how much I appreciate you being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Well, I really appreciate it, Welton. It's great work you do, and, you know, keep it up. We're moving in the right direction.
Now, here's an interesting challenge. Tell the story of God in 6 weekly television episodes. Now, if you don't feel up to it, don't worry. It's already been done and done remarkably well. The series wraps up next weekend on the National Geographic Channel, and joining me now is the series executive producer, James Younger. James, welcome to State of Belief.
Oh, good morning, Walton. Thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
I can't think of a topic more fraught with challenges than a global overview of belief in God. Whose idea was this, and what made you think it could be done?
Well, yeah, it's a really ambitious project, and I must say, when we were sitting down about a year ago with Morgan Freeman and Laurie McCreary, thinking, okay, now we got to do this, and we got 1 year to tell as much of the story of all the world's religions in 6 hours, and in 1 year from now, we were overwhelmed with trepidation, but also excitement.
Sure.
The project was the result of kind of a long simmering conversation and thought process that Morgan Freeman and Laurie McCreary, Laurie is Morgan's producing partner and business partner, were first inspired to think about this when they were in Istanbul about 6 or 7 years ago in this amazing building called the Hagia Sophia. Which was, I believe it dates back to the 5th century as a church, and then later on it was a mosque, and then and later on it became a museum. Now it's a museum.
I've been in that structure. It's a wonderful place.
Amazing place, yeah. And so, you've seen around the place are these amazing mosaics of Jesus and various, chapters from his life. And Morgan and Laurie both were wondering, well, when this was a mosque, were these all painted over or covered up? And the response was, well, not really, because the Jesus is a prophet in Islam. And they were struck with the fact that they did not know that. And, this was struck them, well, if we don't know that, this is a very basic thing. Imagine, and we're interested in religion, all the things that we don't know and that everyone else in the world doesn't know about other people's faith. So it kind of grew from there. And then about 3 years ago, I came into the process. I've been working with Morgan and Laurie on this science-based series called Through the Wormhole, which was kind of asking these big existential questions. Where do we come from? Why are we here? What happens when we die? But through the lens of science. And so that was kind of like a way of sharpening our focus to say, well, if we ask these similar kind of broad questions through the lens of faith, that would be a great way to tackle the story of religion around the world.
How did you make sure that all of the voices that needed to be heard in this process got heard?
We did that a couple of things. One is we, very early on at the beginning, we got an interfaith panel. We got a, we got a Muslim scholar, a Jewish scholar, a Buddhist, a Hindu, a Christian. I've got everyone to come on board and kind of vet our scripting process along the way. And then the second mantra for us was, this is not meant to be a criticism of religion. This is a comparison. And so we're not saying one religion is better than another or has a better way of looking at things. We're trying to just find out the basics of what people feel about fundamental questions in life, and then finding all these unexpected connections between different faiths.
Yeah, I was interested in just how interested in this project Morgan Freeman was, because I think the way he is present in these various segments, it is a great contribution to telling the story. I mean, it's one thing to have Morgan Freeman sit in a studio and narrate a document, but to have him on site and interacting with the people who are the major players in telling the story, and him being, as I see it, as honest and as natural as he could be, I think that gave this a whole new dimension.
Yeah, no, I agree. It was remarkable that he dedicated so much time to it. For a Hollywood icon to spend, we traveled 40 days. We always say, like, we joke, we say we travel for 40 days and 40 nights, and it's pretty much true. And, you know, he was in the thick of it. You've probably, if you've seen the show, you've seen him on the streets of Varanasi in India,
right.
And he's, you know, he's sweating. It's hot.
Mm-hmm.
And he's, you know, working his way through these narrow streets to meet people, talk to people. He's fascinated by the subject.
Mm-hmm.
He has been since he was a teenager, just trying to understand why people believe what they believe and how faith arises in people and why it's so different. So this is kind of, you know, to speak on his behalf, but I'm pretty sure it's true. It's been a passion of his life, of his entire life, to, mm-hmm. to get to the bottom of this. And then what's so great about having someone like Morgan is that he's such a genuine, honest person.
Mm-hmm.
And when you sit, you know, he sits down with somebody, be it a Hindu scholar or an imam, you know, an Islamic imam or a pastor. He has a really direct, honest conversation with them, and that makes people open up. I don't think people see judgment, criticism
mm-hmm.
from him.
Right.
They see an intelligent, questioning, open-minded person, and that just starts a great conversation.
Do you have a favorite segment or scene from this project, and why is it your favorite?
Yeah, it's hard to pick one. You know, there were a couple of things that were surprisingly just wonderful to witness. One of them was the Navajo coming-of-age ceremony for the young Navajo girl in New Mexico, where she goes through this four-day ritual to become a woman, to go from being a girl to a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And to see this, you know, tradition, this old tradition, the kind of power that was put into this young girl, that this young girl mustered for herself and through her belief and through her family support to kind of have this spiritual connection with the Navajo ancestors and the Navajo gods
mm-hmm.
to drive her towards womanhood, to give her the strength to take on the challenges of womanhood. That was remarkable. The other thing that I was really, I would say Morgan and I were both a little bit surprised to find so emotionally powerful was to be at Joel Osteen's
mm-hmm.
megachurch in Lakewood.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess I didn't really thought too much about, you know, the preachers and pastors you see on television.
Mm-hmm.
And I maybe had this impression that it wasn't very authentic or it was a show or it was overly produced and may not really represent true
mm-hmm.
faith. I mean, that was my just, you know, not mm-hmm. very well researched, but just my passing impression of that. But then when we went there, we found the whole service to be really honest and really uplifting. And you could just feel this emotion, this place of all these mm-hmm. people coming together and having a religious, a emotional experience together. It was really, really surprising and very, very positive.
You all met so many people of diverse traditions. Do you have any hint, any impression of how, if you got all of those people together, they would relate to each other?
Well, I think they would find they had a lot more to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot more they would agree about what their purpose was in life, what their goal. Everyone disagrees on the details, and, you know, how
right.
do you practice your religion? What are the actual tenets of your faith?
Mm-hmm.
But if you ask people a question, if you go to a Buddhist monk or a Catholic priest or a Christian pastor or an Islamic imam and say, well, what is it that you hope to achieve through faith?
Mm-hmm.
What is it you want to change in people, in themselves, or in the world, in the way people relate to one another? I think you would find remarkable similarities in the
mm-hmm.
goals of religion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's about living a better life, being true to yourself, being caring about others, and try to leave this world a better place than you found it.
You know, I'm really glad that you were willing to answer that question, and I'm also glad to hear your answer, because in my own way of thinking, what you have just said is an integral part of the authentic story of the story of God. And I think you said it so well. There are 2 weeks left to the story of God on the National Geographic Channel. Give us a brief description of those two.
Well, this weekend, this Sunday, the episode is called "Why Does Evil Exist?" And so, you know, you think about that. Like, if you believe in God and you believe God is good and God created the world, then why did God allow evil to mm-hmm. exist? And why does evil continue to exist? So we look at, you know, we have Morgan goes to meet a convicted criminal, a psychopathic criminal, to try and understand, kind of, is there a mental root of evil? Mm-hmm. We discuss the original sin. We also have a really interesting story on the religion Zoroastrianism.
Hmm.
Have you heard of Zoroastrianism?
Oh yes, I have.
And you know, it's a very ancient religion from ancient Persia, was influential in the idea of the devil developing. You know, the concept of the devil wasn't very strong in Judaism,
mm-hmm.
but then became strong in Christianity, largely because of the influence of Zoroastrianism.
Right.
So we talk about we visit some Zoroastrians. It's really really enlightening. And then the final week of the series is on the power of miracles. Like what? Why miracles? Why belief in miracles and the place of miracles is so important in so many faiths, and what they tell us about about the interaction between the divine mm-hmm. and the material world
mm-hmm.
and the search for understanding what God may or may not do.
Mm-hmm.
And also, we look into Buddhism. We go to the Bodhi tree in India and have a really fascinating segment with a Buddhist monk who explains the place of miracles in Buddhism and in the life of Buddha.
James, what are the plans for the availability of this series after the broadcast is complete?
Well, I don't know all of the details of that. The folks at National Geographic Channel do the details of that. But right now, it is available on iTunes and on Google Play and on various online services. And so you'll be able to, if you have some kind of smart television or an iPad or the Internet, you can watch it in that form. I'm sure it will be released on Blu-ray at some point, but I will have to find out from the folks at National Geographic exactly the details of that.
James, one last question. I'm just curious. How did working on this series change you? What did you learn along the way that made you feel differently?
I really learned about this universal need for faith, for mm-hmm. religious practice, for communal worship or meditation of some sort. People around the world, human beings, I think, have a universal need to come together to get away from their day-to-day life and think about something longer term. Think about, as you might say, the eternal.
Mm-hmm.
And to come together in this moment of, let's say, meditation, whatever you might call it, but it's a form of meditation, and get beyond themselves
mm-hmm.
and to kind of face the unknown with other people, side by side with their fellow worshipers, and be strengthened by that. I think I found that everywhere, in Hinduism, Buddhism, in Christianity, in Judaism, mm-hmm. in Islam. That's a universal need, and I really didn't appreciate, I don't think, the power and need for that in the world.
James Younger is a longtime television producer who served as executive producer on the 6-part series, The Story of God, with Morgan Freeman. James, what a project. Thanks so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you for having me, and it was a pleasure, and I'm so glad you're enjoying the series, and I hope your listeners do too.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. I'm going to tell you what, if you didn't get excited about these interviews today, you need to have another cup of coffee or something, because these are fascinating interviews that take us to the heart of what's going on in our politics and in our religion. Thank you for letting us do this. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you because you're responsible for allowing us to have these kind of interviews on the air. And if you've heard something on this week's show that you think would be helpful to someone you know, please share it with them. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes and in-depth archives, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. Surely you know someone that needs to hear that interview about planned intentional ignorance. The community that's grown around State of Belief Radio is active all week long online. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the discussion. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. You never know what you may hear. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man.